And today's In the Field takes us to Melbourne's Federation Square, where we join former RN host Peter Mayers, hosting a panel with guests Jane Frances Kelly from the Grattan Institute and economist Ian Harper from Deloitte's. This month, we've been featuring a lot about city life, the pros and cons and challenges of living in our cities. And today we look at some of the so-called soft issues, things like loneliness, for example, and how our emotions are shaping our modern lives in cities. So today's In the Field examines some of the issues in the Grattan Institute's Social Cities Report, and you can see a link to this report on our website. So let's now join host Peter Mayers and the panellists Jane Frances Kelly and Ian Harper and the audience.
So this is our topic, social cities. Jane Frances Kelly, what is a social city?
So the first report that we published in the Grattan Cities Programme is called The Cities We Need. And in that report, we argued that cities have to do a lot of things well at the same time. We tend to more concentrate on people's material needs in those cities. And, you know, even, you know, at Grattan, we've spent a lot of time writing about kind of housing, shelter, and obviously, you know, jobs, income, the economy is critically important. But humans also have psychological needs, and social connection, which is our relationships with others, is one of the most important of those. And that's both the close regular contact that we have with family and close friends, also the kind of incidental interaction that you have with people on the street. And it's enormously important because cities are basically people who have decided to live together. So we started with people and asked what was important to them.
There are lots of things about cities. Well, I suppose lots of urgent issues in cities. I mean, things like housing you mentioned, but public transport might be another, the carbon footprint of cities, lots of stuff I could think of. Why did Grattan feel it was important to look at this particular side of things, the social nature of our cities?
Mm, and in fact, you know, one of the early readers of the report kind of said, why is a serious institution like Grattan looking at a fluffy issue like this? So it was important for us to explain why. Humans are social animals, and you know, often if you ask a group of people like this one in this room to close their eyes and just to think quickly about what's the most important thing in their lives, people will often visualize their relationships with their loved ones and their close friends. And the opposite of social connection is loneliness and isolation. And it turns out that that's much worse for us than we previously realized. So people who are chronically lonely die earlier. And so essentially loneliness over time is a risk factor for early death in the same way that smoking or obesity is. Australia does relatively well compared to other countries on indicators of social connection. You know, Australians have, you know, in terms of the number of friends that people have, the number of people feel that they can call on in an emergency and so on. But those indicators are declining over time. And particularly worryingly, the groups in society who are most prone to loneliness and isolation are growing, and that's older people, people who live by themselves, sole parents, and people with limited English.
But what does that have to do with cities? I mean, how can, you know, isn't that a factor of lots of other things, like, you know, we work too hard or we work too long, or, you know, our husbands die before we do and we have 10 years of being a widow? I mean, what can cities do about that sort of stuff?
No, absolutely. There are lots of other things that affect our relationships with others, everything from individual disposition to family situation, you know. But what this report does is argue that the way that we build and organise our cities does make a difference. I mean, cities can help or hinder connection. They can bring people together or keep them apart. And I'll just give a couple of examples of the kind of things we mean. At the overall kind of shape of the city, city structure kind of level, whether there's decent transport infrastructure makes a big difference, because you have to be able to get around to see people. If you live on a street where there's heavy traffic, you know fewer people on the street. Even when it comes to the design of parks, you know, people will kind of sometimes say there isn't enough green space in an area or so on, but often it's that there is enough space, it's just not designed very well, and sort of small kind of often counterintuitive things can be changed, even, you know, the placement of park benches that make these places work much, much better.
Ian Harper, what's an economist's take on this sort of fluffy stuff about cities and social connection?
Well, I think an economist is sort of fascinated, intrigued. One of the interesting developments in economics over the last 10 or 15, maybe even 20 years, is that the boundaries between economics as a study really focused on material factors and material well-being have become more porous. I welcome that myself. I think it's a terrific development, and it takes economics back, in fact, into its own history. So I think, Peter, that an economist is not surprised, refreshed, I think, but would also want to bring to the analysis some quite penetrating questions about measurement. So I think that an economist finds it quite easy to come at the proposition which says that there's more to human welfare than the narrowly material. We're often accused as economists of knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing, to paraphrase Oscar Wilde. I think that's a calumny on the profession. I think any well-trained economist knows that we're just looking at one dimension of human welfare. But what we've tended to do is to think that, well, the rest of it is too hard to measure, therefore it's not important. That's the bit which is a mistake.
I want to pick up on a couple of things there. First of all, you said that this kind of approach takes you back into economic history. What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, economics began as a branch of moral philosophy. So the whole understanding of the human person, as a moral sentient being, that's the ground from which economics sprang originally. And then, of course, political science and sociology and economics, all psychology, all branched off. But in more recent times, with the development of what we call behavioral economics, I think we're rediscovering links between economics and psychology in particular that I think are to the benefit of both of those disciplines.
The other thing I wanted to pick up on and what you said was you talked about an economist would ask rigorous questions about measurement. And isn't that exactly the problem here, that these things like life satisfaction, well-being, loneliness, they're very difficult things to measure, aren't they?
Well, they are, Peter, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. And there are numerous projects which, broadly speaking, fall under the rubric of what's called the economics of happiness, sort of loose and, to some extent, maybe even oxymoronic term for some people, where people are trying to measure these different ways of coming at a broader indicator of human welfare than simply the material. One comes to mind specifically in relation to relationships. An economist by the name of Michael Schluter, some members of the audience might have heard of Michael, works at Cambridge University. And Michael's an ex-economist from the World Bank. And he's made his research over the last few years specifically devoted to measuring relationships. And he actually speaks about a measure of human welfare, which is built on economic welfare and adds to it relationships. You'd need to look at the research to get an idea of how he goes about measuring it, but I think that he's headed in the right direction, in a very similar direction to Jane's work.
So you, as an economist, accept the argument that we should put the social side of our cities higher on the agenda?
Without going into any of the things I've just talked about, obviously it's been a matter of concern to governments down the ages, like what's happening in the city. And in a modern state like our own, whether the city actually exacerbates the incidence of various types of social distress. Even setting aside the human dimension of that, the distress which we maybe can't measure, there are obvious costs associated with that, which tend to redound on the government and obviously on the taxpayer. So even if I was to take, Peter, a very narrow economistic view of this, it's still part of the agenda.
Well, let me put that question another way. If we were at Grattan getting you to come along to the meetings we have with people in Treasury, for example, how would you sell this idea? How would you go about convincing people who are counting the dollars that this ought to be up there for consideration?
Well, the way that you catch the attention of Treasuries, in my experience, is to talk about productivity. And I think that at the moment, with the national productivity performance being so lamentable, as people I imagine would know, at least you ought to if you don't, that my colleagues are very focused on anything that might even potentially improve productivity performance, particularly in economies like the Victorian economy, which are increasingly dominated by services. And there's a big puzzle in economics about how you can generate productivity improvements from which our living standards ultimately flow in industries like services. Now, I think that Jane Francis's work gives us a hint of how that might happen. that services-dominated economies won't just produce improved material welfare through those connections, but can actually build human welfare more broadly, and that feeds back onto the underlying economic mechanism at work here. So to paraphrase that, economists have long understood that welfare, economic welfare, is generated by transactions amongst people, but those transactions need not have any human dimension other than I've got what you want and vice versa. When you add in the relationship dimension, you can build on the capacity of those transactions to deliver value across a broader front.
You're listening to By Design on ABC RN and to our special panel examining the issues confronting us as our cities grow. Our host is Peter Mayers for this very special event at Melbourne's Federation Square, and our guests are the Grattan Institute's Jane Frances Kelly and economist Ian Harper. Links on our website.
Jane Frances Kelly, so we're talking here about things, I mean, you've used the term social connection, but are we talking, is that the same as social capital or social trust, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, they're all related, but we've tried quite hard to be clear about what we're talking about in social connection. It is, however, a building block for social trust, social capital, and it's related to other issues like social inclusion. Sometimes it can all seem like it gets very muddy because they all use the term social. And we played around with using the term relatedness, but there's no great term for it, unfortunately.
And a lot of the things in the report, some people who are urban planners or architects might say, well, we know all this stuff. You know, we learnt this in first year university or second year university. How do you respond to that sort of critique of a report like this?
Oh, look, you know, they're absolutely right. This isn't new. And there are many people over many years who have dedicated their careers to the types of things that we're talking about in the report. What we were aiming to do was to make the case, again, for the importance of social connection and to bring together a lot of the of what we know about what works and what doesn't work. Look, all the feedback we've been getting so far is that people find that really useful. So, for example, at kind of a local council type level, the politics of this kind of thing can be quite difficult. I mentioned earlier that some of the things that make places much more attractive and lively to people and so on are quite counterintuitive. So it can be quite difficult to kind of sort of make the case for investing, you know, even if it's a relatively small amount of money in it. What we hope to do with this and with having kind of conversations like these and so on is to give those people more ammunition for making the case.
Can you explain a bit more what you mean about it being counterintuitive sometimes, how these things work?
Well, it was fascinating learning, you know, about this kind of stuff. Sometimes it's even just the placement of benches. You know, if you have an area and you put benches in the middle of it, people won't sit on them because it feels too exposed and so on. But if you put the benches around the edge of the area, then people will sit on them. Another example is if a building presents a blank wall to the street, then people don't enjoy walking past it. It can feel like a bit of a wind tunnel. But if a building kind of lands on the street with alcoves and steps and so on, then you'll find that people will sit down and use them and again, then attract other people.
Peter, perhaps another way to put the link between this work and economics is that we're going to invest a whole lot more in our cities over time. And there is increasing emphasis on cities, again, in a services-dominated context, as being engines of prosperity. And I guess the concern that economists, if they haven't got it now, they ought to have it, which is where Jane Frances' work is pointing. If we want to make these cities become engines of prosperity, members of the audience who would have seen a recent report produced by the Victorian Competition and Efficiency Commission, my economist colleagues, pointing out that one source of competitive economic advantage for our state is the city of Melbourne and how it works and articulates with its near region, right? That's a source of competitive advantage. That's economists saying that. The problem is, if we then invest in the city as a source of competitive advantage and it becomes a social hellhole, we've just undone all the good work we've been seeking to do. So I think there's where the confluence of ideas comes, that economists say we need these cities to generate the economies of scale which will build prosperity. What do we do about all the potential external social costs? And we have little to say about that.
Things like congestion, for example.
Indeed. Congestion, yeah. and the more subtle points that Jane Francis's work is making about isolation and mental illness and such like, things that economists, well, you know, we don't understand that. What we don't want is the economists to ignore it.
But that raises another issue, and I'd like responses from both you, Ian Harper, and Jane Francis Kelly, and that is whether our cities can keep getting bigger. Because if you, as you say, if the city becomes an engine of economic growth, and if it's well designed and a nice place to live, more people will come. It will keep getting bigger. Some people would argue you destroy the social nature of the city because it becomes too big.
Well, I think there lies the challenge. As if I understand my economics of the cities correctly, and there'll be experts here who may correct me on this, I believe we're yet to plumb the extent of the scale economies which are possible through city agglomeration. These clustering effects and agglomeration effects that Jane Francis refers to, they're real, and they generate wealth. Now, the wealth that's generated can be turned back or ploughed back into developing the type of amenity that you're referring to here. So I think, Peter, it is a virtuous circle. But in order to understand how that fully articulates, you need to be thinking about these issues as well as how to make cities just engines of growth.
Jane Francis?
What we've found in kind of going through the literature is that it suggests it's not about size, it's about how the city is designed and operates. Yeah, and also there's no one housing type which is more friendly for social connection, no one level of density. The problems of growth are very challenging, but they're much easier to deal with than the problems of decline.
Then if our cities are going to grow, and the projections are that cities like Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth, Australia's major cities are all growing, if that's the case, what about things like solitude and privacy?
These things are all a balance, and when we talk about the high association that exists, for example, between knowing your neighbours and well-being, we're not suggesting that everyone has to make friends with their neighbours and have dinner with them and so on. We all have different preferences for the amount of interaction that we want with others in our lives, and the balance is the key thing. We are not just social animals, we're also territorial animals. And so if the demarcation of what is private and what is public is not clear, then, you know, humans tend to kind of make it clearer, and kind of you can imagine they'll sort of barricade themselves in and have up handwritten signs saying private, keep out, and don't even think about, you know, turning your car around my driveway and all of those kinds of things. So we're certainly not trying to force anyone into any level of interaction that they don't want. Although, of course, if people do want to make friends with their neighbours, it's a liberal democracy, they should go for their lives.
But what you're saying is that if you get those territorial markings right, if you like, the soft edges around buildings, then you can actually encourage interaction.
That's right. So, you know, as long as it is clear what is your private space so that you know you can retreat into it when that's what you need, you're more willing to come out and interact with others, you know, including strangers. Yeah.
Professor Ian Harper, another question would be, does all this matter in a digital age when we're all connected to each other via Facebook or Twitter or email or mobile phones and all the rest of it? Doesn't that diminish the importance of this focus on actually the physical contact between people that's in this report?
Well, Peter, we're often told that. That's true. And people say, well, there are virtual communities these days and we don't need to be so reliant on physical communities. I had a little bit of insight into this when we were asked a year or so ago by the City of Melbourne to investigate Melbourne's financial services centre and what clustering, what evidence for clustering there was and why there was clustering. Some fairly simple mapping demonstrated that our financial services centre here in this city has an L shape stretched down Collins Street, which is not too hard for people to imagine, all the way down into the Docklands, and then down Exhibition Street up the other end to Castledon Place, with a sort of funds managers over at Castledon Place and the bankers stretched down, and all in between, lots of boutique financial services centres. Now, I mention that for two reasons, Peter. Firstly, financial services is, hyper-digitalized.
It's the ultimate online industry, isn't it?
Exactly. People in this industry don't need to leave their desks to be trading vast amounts of money anywhere in the world. And yet, one, they do cluster. They're not stuck in the suburbs or in the Pacific Islands or in the middle of Australia. They do cluster. And when you ask them why they cluster, they will talk to you about, the importance of being able to have coffee with a colleague at a social level, and the importance of being able to see your colleagues and customers and others on the tram going up and down Collins Street. Indeed, one of the people we interviewed, and I'm sure he won't mind my saying so because it was a public report, was the former chairman of the Future Fund, David Murray, who said, look, he said, I'm from Sydney, and I'm just stunned. I was cynical originally about the government's decision to locate the Future Fund here in Melbourne, but having been here now for a while, I'm amazed at how the Collins Street tram network works and what all my colleagues do in this area. He said, never change any of this if you want to build the financial services centre in Melbourne.
Jane Francis, that incidental contact does seem to be, you know, the chance encounters with people you're associated with or know, that does seem to be very important, doesn't it?
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I just sort of go back to kind of saying we're humans, and I don't think that's going to change.
This is By Design on ABC RN, and you're listening to a panel examining the issues confronting us as our cities grow. Our host is former RN presenter Peter Mez, and we're at a special event at Melbourne's Federation Square with our guests, the Grattan Institute's Jane Frances Kelly and economist Ian Harper.
I want to come back, though, to one other issue in the report, and that's the role of the car, because Jane Frances Kelly, you talked earlier about the fact that if you live on a very busy street in terms of traffic, you're less likely to know your neighbours. But on the other hand, the report talks about the importance of mobility, of getting around, of being able to access activities, friends, jobs and so on. And the car, in Australia at least, is a great source of mobility. So how do you balance these two things? On the one hand, you're saying cars are bad. On the other hand, you're saying cars are good.
We do see arterial roads are really important because, as we say, it is really important to get around, and often that is by car. What we also spoke about, though, was that on roads which are not arterial roads, are not primarily designed for kind of ease of getting around at speed, so on kind of shopping commercial streets and in residential streets, we've sort of pointed out that the car seems to win by default in the, you know, the sort of weighing up the needs of people, pedestrians, and weighing up the needs of the car. And that's what we're questioning. You know, it sort of just seems that that kind of happens without kind of much thought. And for example, in residential streets and so on, and I kind of go over them on my scooter every time I go home, more and more speed bumps are being put in. And these things are kind of uncomfortable to go over, and that's because they're designed to slow cars down. And I just want to sort of say, we could trial lower speed limits.
Because those speed bumps are actually designed to slow you down to a speed far lower than the actual speed limit.
Exactly. So we talk about the possibility of having shared streets where the demarcation between what's for vehicles and what's for people is less clear. And what that does is it kind of slows cars down, but makes people much more comfortable about using the street for a whole range of activities. And everybody just sort of looks out for each other.
Okay, do we have questions from the audience?
There's been a fair bit of development at the moment where developers are saying that they're creating these vertical villages with community in mind, creating community within the actual high-rise development. Do you think that those sorts of developments have a place, or it's more of a cynical venture to sell more apartments? Do you think they're useful?
So, Jane Francis, vertical communities, is that...
Are developers cynical or not?
Is it spin?
I'm sure that in some cases it's mostly spin, and in some other cases they're genuinely giving it a really good go. I think those kind of things are really important. We talked about single-person households earlier, and the people who live by themselves are most prone of all households to loneliness. What that means is that, you know, by definition, any social connection that someone has living by themselves kind of happens outside the household. designing buildings, apartment buildings, so that they have shared spaces that actually work is a great idea. Particularly the other kind of aspect of it is that a lot of those single person households are older people. You know, when people know each other kind of within a building, then they can look out for each other. So if someone hasn't been seen for a couple of days, or somebody who checks up, and if somebody is sick, then the dog gets walked and so on. Again, we know things about kind of what makes those work and what makes those kind of shared spaces work and so on. The challenge that a lot of developers face, I think, is that that becomes space that you're not selling as part of an apartment. And so they sort of say it's quite difficult to get the numbers to add up, and it kind of makes it more expensive. I mean, actually, the work we did last year on the nature of the housing market and on building a construction innovation in non-detached houses is really important there. We need to get much better at figuring out how to build sort of apartment buildings and so on better and cheaper, so that we can afford, you know, kind of better design.
Ian Hubbard, that is a challenge for developers, isn't it? If they're going to devote a certain amount of shared space, a certain amount of space in a building to shared activities or communal space, that's perhaps one less or two less apartments they can sell, which cuts into their profit margin.
Well, Peter, it's a classic instance of what economists call a public goods problem. The difficulty is, how can you get the market to respond and to deliver these goods, these social amenities that we all want to put our hands up and say, this is terrific, right? Who's going to pay? Now, to some extent, the market will be led, it'll lead itself to that, but only to some extent. So, for example, there are a lot of co-housing arrangements for retired people, and many elderly and retired people don't need to be convinced of the value of living close to one another for physical security, for companionship, shared amenity, all that sort of thing, and the developers respond, they deliver that product. So, as economists often say with public goods problems, don't assume it's black and white and that the market can do nothing and it all has to be by regulation or government fiat. The trick with solving public goods problems is to try to work out how far the market will take you and at what point you need then to govern or press or push or incentivize the market in some way.
And how would you intervene? Do you intervene
whether it's by tax or regulation?
Or planning rules or...
Precisely, and there are many people who could tell you that stories of well-intentioned interventions which have gone wrong. Yes, you do want some common space in your building, so you tell the developers you must do this, and the developer builds you an enormous ground floor plaza that nobody uses, and the developer ticks the box. So it's a difficult thing to get right, Peter, but I guess my point is, don't give up on the market entirely. It's not all spin. The market can resolve these issues in certain cases when as people's tastes and preferences change. But clearly, in this instance, there's obviously going to be some residual role, maybe a more prominent role in some cases, for public dirigism, telling the market what has to happen.
Okay, we have another question.
Hi, my name's Gemma. I'm a graduate architect, and so I suppose my interest is what your opinion is regarding our adaptability to change. For instance, some places in Scandinavia, we're seeing co-housing that makes cities efficient by pairing elderly with single parents, so that when they go to work, the elderly can look after the children, so that there's symbiotic relationships created through architecture. And then considering micro-housing in Japan and in China, where they almost adapt by projecting a lot of their needs into the city and having a very small public space, and whether Australians, whether we've always been used to having wide open spaces, how perhaps there's a capacity in our cities and we can never, you know, enter in those great millions of billions of people that live in cities in other countries. Can we adapt?
Yeah, Francis.
I completely agree. I mean, as Ian kind of put it, that, you know, retirement villages are as an example of co-housing, but you see very few examples in Australia of co-housing developments that are for non-older people, as it were. There are many, many more of them in America and in Europe, as you mentioned, and in Denmark, 10% of all housing that is built now is on a co-housing model. Look, I think that as single-person household continues to grow, but that it will increase. I mean, there's a whole series of incentives in the housing market at the moment that make it very difficult to set those kinds of things up. But those, you know, that we need to kind of take a look at the rules of the game to try and kind of shift the incentives so that they are easier. I think there's also a demonstration issue. When there are so few, then people are kind of not quite sure what it is, and it's sort of interesting. You know, I sort of would mention co-housing, and people kind of say, "Oh, well, do you mean hippies who live in communes?" And you know, sort of say, "Well, no." But you know, if that's all that people have ever kind of heard of or seen, then they're going to be more hesitant.
Please join me in thanking Ian Harper and Jane Frances Coe.
And there we leave our special In the Field today at Melbourne's Federation Square with host Peter Mayers, examining the Grattan Institute's Social Cities Report that was released in early 2012. All links on our website, and credits to Paul Penton, who recorded that event. And if you have any comments about social cities or what you've just heard, we would love to hear from you. Go to our website or Facebook to get in touch. And that's By Design for today. By Design is produced by Jan Ryan. Our sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, and I'm Fenella Kernebone.